Support for Living on Earth comes from listeners like you. To make a donation, please use the link to the left of this webpage. And thanks.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. From the carpets in our living rooms to the liners of our canned goods, we're exposed to man-made chemicals every day. We use synthetic chemicals for everything from plastics to pesticides. They eventually make their way from our farms, households, or industry into the environment and into our bodies. And they may be affecting our reproductive health, indeed even our sexual preferences. Producer Ashley Ahern reports.
So these are South African clawed frog. Yep. Xenopus levis.
Tyrone Hayes peers into a large gray fiberglass tank, like a little boy looking for critters in a tide pool. Below the surface, fat greenish-yellow frogs swim around, their bulging eyes looking up at us through the water.
So in this tank, there are 40 brothers that are not exposed to atrazine. In this tank, there's 40 brothers that are exposed to atrazine. And so we can compare these two tubs and look at the number of homosexual pairs. So this, for example, is one that has lots of gay males and homosexual pairs in it because it's a treated tank.
One morning, when one of Hayes' PhD students came in to feed the specimens at 7 a.m., she noticed some male-on-male copulation going on in a tank that had been treated with atrazine, the second most commonly used herbicide in the U.S. Once Hayes heard about this, he started collecting data. He exposed some of his frogs to the same level of atrazine that the Environmental Protection Agency says is safe for drinking water. And he kept the rest of the frogs atrazine-free.
So what you can see is that there's a sevenfold difference in the atrazine-treated animals.
Homosexual behavior has been recorded in over 450 different species of animals, from bison to beetles. But Hayes' research showed that atrazine exposure made these frogs 7 times more prone to homosexual behavior, and 10% of the exposed frogs actually became feminized. To explain what he meant by feminized, Hayes brought me back to his office and pulled up a picture on his laptop of a frog that had been exposed to the herbicide.
So this is an animal that looked like a female on the outside, but on the inside it had large testes, so these are testes, and this is an oviduct. So this is the equivalent of a man with a uterus.
These frogs aren't just behaving like females. They're actually producing eggs. And when those eggs are fertilized by normal male frogs, the babies grow up to be seemingly normal frogs. Let me say that again. The male frogs are having babies. And there are consequences.
Because they don't have a female chromosome, the females that are genetically male can only produce other males. And so 100% of their offspring would be males.
And more male frogs means fewer babies down the road. Hayes says this might be one reason that populations of frogs and other amphibians all over the world are going down.
In our work with frogs, for example, we can go into the field. We've done this. Others have done this. There's another study that just came out in Canada showing that if you go to an environment that's contaminated with atrazine, you find more hermaphroditic or abnormally developed males.
The reproductive problems Hayes is seeing in his specimens aren't limited to frogs. Studies on rats, reptiles, and even human cells exposed to atrazine showed similar results. Recently, scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey found intersex fish in 1/3 of the waterways they tested across the United States. And atrazine is not the only chemical to blame for causing widespread reproductive health problems. It's a member of a family of chemicals known as endocrine disruptors.
Well, basically, they are chemicals that have been around for quite a while. We just didn't know what they were doing.
Dr. Theo Colborne was one of the first to sound the alarm on endocrine disruptors and how they affect reproductive health and development when she co-authored the book Our Stolen Future in the late 90s. At first, people saw her as a bit of a radical. But over a decade later, the government is channeling more and more funding towards researching these chemicals. And there's a new act in Congress that will require better testing of suspected endocrine disruptors. Colborne says it's about time. We're constantly exposed to them.
They're in plastics. They're in our toys, the children's toys. If you go to your kitchen sink and under your bathroom sink and look at the cleaning compounds that are there, the cosmetics, the toiletries, they're just about in everything because they've made every one of these products much nicer. They last longer. They're preservatives. They're fire retardants.
The endocrine system is made up of a series of glands throughout the body that control the hormonal messages that direct development. By imitating natural hormones, such as estrogen and androgen, endocrine-disrupting chemicals prevent the body from sending and receiving those messages. Dr. Steven Rosenthal, a pediatric endocrinologist at the University of California, San Francisco, broke down some basic human developmental biology for me. He says in the womb, we all start out developing as girls.
If you consider the gonads, which basically is the other name for either the testes or the ovaries, in any baby, either a boy or girl, that basically these gonads are pre-programmed to become ovaries unless there's an overriding signal that tells them to become testes.
If you're a boy, that overriding signal comes from a gene on your Y chromosome. It tells your gonads to become testes instead of ovaries and to start producing testosterone and androgen. Those hormones then travel through the body and hook up with receptors in cells.
That sets off a chain of events inside the cell. It's like if you need a key and an ignition to start a car, right? So the key goes into the ignition and then the whole thing can turn and the car goes on.
The car going on would equate to normal development of a fetus. Now picture some chewing gum in the ignition. The key won't fit, the car won't start, or as Rosenthal explains, normal masculine development won't proceed.
If there is some agent, some environmental disruptor that interferes with the normal functioning of the androgen receptor, then it's very likely that in a male there will be incomplete masculinization of the external genitalia.
The atrazine-exposed male frogs in Tyrone Hayes's lab look just like females, which are much larger than the typical male African claw frog and have smaller breeding glands and differently formed feet and gonads. Tyrone Hayes says just because frogs aren't people, that doesn't mean we should ignore the warnings.
Because people always go, well, it's frogs. And I go, but look, the estrogen that works in this frog is exactly, chemically, exactly the same as the estrogen that regulates female reproduction. Exactly the same testosterone that's in these frogs regulating their larynx or their voice box and their breeding glands and their sperm count is exactly the same hormone in rats and in us.
So what about us? Could endocrine disruptors be having feminizing effects in humans? No one knows for sure, but some believe that rising rates of one birth defect could be an indicator. Dr. Lawrence Baskin is a pediatric urologist with the University of California, San Francisco. But he practices here at the Oakland Children's Hospital part-time. Today, he's performing back-to-back surgeries, and a very specific type of surgery. Baskin specializes in correcting hypospadias, the second most common birth defect in the country behind heart disease.
About 1 in 125 to 1 in 250 newborn males has an abnormality in their genitalia that can be described as hypospadias. And what I mean by that is penile curvature, abnormal urethra, and an abnormal foreskin. And putting that together, that's what hypospadias is defined at.
More babies are born with hypospadias than Down syndrome or cleft palate. And some research suggests that rates of hypospadias have increased in the past few decades. Baskin and others in his field suspect environmental exposures may contribute to hypospadias. Think back to the gummed-up lock and key that Steven Rosenthal described. All fetuses are programmed to develop ovaries unless they're told otherwise by certain hormones like testosterone and androgen. Endocrine-disrupting chemicals, like atrazine, for example, could gum up the receptors for those hormonal messengers that tell a fetus to develop into a baby boy. Or as Baskin explains, prevent the fetus from fully masculinizing.
The penis wouldn't develop, it would be arrested, meaning that your urethral opening would be lower down in the penile shaft. The penis normally, as it develops, is curved and it straightens out. So in hypospadias, it wouldn't have straightened out. And the foreskin would only form on the top of the penis and wouldn't be able to come around to the bottom because that lock or that hormone receptor would be blocked or disrupted by the environmental toxin.
Okay. So if Tyrone Hayes is finding feminizing effects in frogs who are exposed to atrazine, one of these environmental toxins that Baskin is talking about, are there some parallels to be drawn in human beings? Baskin pauses for just a split second before responding.
Humans clearly are not frogs, but the theory is correct, and in this case we would agree with Dr. Hayes that an environmental disruptor, something in the environment, a chemical toxin or a medication, could certainly be a risk factor for hypospadias.
Baskin says the majority of hypospadias can be fixed with a relatively quick surgery that can make life a lot easier for the child later on.
I think growing up as a teenager and not having normal genitalia would be tough enough, even if you have normal genitalia, just for regular emotional and sexual development. That's really the major reason to fix it so kids can be normal.
But normal is a loaded term for some. Dr. Tiger Howard DeVore is a sex therapist and clinical psychologist in New York City.
Isn't it great that some doctor can tell you what's normal? I love that.
For DeVore, this is a personal story.
One of my earliest memories is of being in the hospital and dealing with some physician taking bandages off of my genitals and, you know, watching my parents respond in obvious fear about whatever it was that this guy was doing. I was probably maybe 3, but I had my first surgery when I was 3 months old. And I had at least one surgery every year after that until I was at least 12.
DeVore was born with severe hypospadias. All told, he's had 20 operations on his penis. It wasn't until college that DeVore came to terms with his condition and decided to devote himself to helping others born with hypospadias. As a psychologist, he says that if you follow Rosenthal and Baskin's logic and look at hypospadias as incomplete masculinization of the genitals,
the same thing probably happened in the brain in the areas where there's a sexual differentiation of the brain. Now, it doesn't make a person gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transsexual, but it certainly makes it easier for that person to be any of those things.
There is no peer-reviewed scientific research to back up DeVore's claim about sexual orientation and hypospadias. However, the Hypospadias and Epispadias Association, a group which works to raise awareness about these two similar genital conditions, conducted an online survey of roughly 700 men, both with hypospadias and without. The survey found that men with hypospadias were 15% more likely to describe themselves as gay. I told DeVore about Tyrone Hayes, the biologist at Berkeley with the homosexual and feminized frogs, and I asked him what he thought about those findings in relation to people. He said the connection makes sense.
But we can't prove it because we can't experiment on human beings. We can certainly look at the populational models and say, this looks like it's pretty closely related. We probably should take some actions here to see if it is, but we can't say that we know the whole story yet.
DeVore says there's a whole lot more to someone's sexual orientation than the chemicals they may have been exposed to during development.
This isn't just about where you stick your things, and this isn't just about how you get good sensation in your body. This is about who you fall in love with. This is about a whole complex set of social factors.
It's a cool, rainy day in Massachusetts when I pull into Alice's dirt driveway and walk up the steps to her log cabin-style home.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
You found us out here in the woods.
Can you come here? Where are the chocolate chips?
You gonna melt them?
At 7 years old, Alice's son's red head is just above counter level.
Done.
He gets a spoon to mush the melted chocolate chips around and comes back out to sit with his mom and me at the kitchen table.
I mean, I talked to him about it personally. You know, he knows he has hypospadias and he knows that he's met other people that have it.
Since her son was born, Alice has worked to raise awareness about hypospadias. She also counsels mothers of kids with hypospadias. But she says more attention needs to be paid to figuring out what causes this condition and communicating that information with the public.
What concerns me the most is that the information is there, that these environmental estrogens are having effects. It's common sense. I mean, if this is what's happening, why isn't the information getting out there? I guess my big question that I have is, why can't people talk about it? Why can't we talk about it as a society?
Talking about problems with reproductive health is something society has never handled well. And perhaps because most hypospadias can be corrected with surgery, very few doctors have raised questions about the underlying causes of this birth defect. But endocrine-disrupting chemicals show up in almost 100% of the population, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And many of these chemicals are known to disrupt normal reproductive system development in animals. Think back to Tyrone Hayes' frogs here. So I asked Dr. Theo Colborne, who's been studying endocrine disruptors for over 30 years, if she thought our environmental exposures could be affecting our reproductive health. Or more specifically, given what we're seeing with hypospadias, I asked her, do you think we're feminizing our baby boys?
I definitely do. I think there's a certain percentage that are definitely being affected, and there's no denying it.
It's one thing to say that exposure to endocrine-disrupting chemicals may contribute to hypospadias. It's quite another to say that a person's sexual orientation could be shaped in part by their environmental exposures. That, Colborne says, is an explosive issue. No one wants to touch that research.
If you were to ask for dollars for that, you wouldn't get the money. I mean, you would be laughed out of your chair, believe me. It's that sensitive.
Sensitive, and therefore still very early in terms of scientific findings and evidence. But important questions are now being raised. What effects might chemicals in our environment, particularly those to which we are exposed before birth, have on our reproductive health and on the expression of sexual identity? For Living on Earth, I'm Ashley Ahern.
Thanks for support from the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California. If you have thoughts, we'd love to hear them at comments@loe.org. That's comments@loe.org, or on our listener line, 1-800-218-9988, or via our Facebook page. It's PRI's Living on Earth.